My name is Clancy Immerslin. I'm an alcoholic.
Clancy.
It's a very good honor to be the second speaker today. I guess there's not much left for me to say. But I'm glad to be here this afternoon. I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober, as I like to say. I'm glad to be part of this meeting. I want to do something I've never done before. I don't know why I do it. I guess some weakness in me. But I want to thank Shirali for making all this possible. Some years ago, she came to me with this idea of starting this conference, restarting this conference. And she and her aide, Sharon B., and I said, that'd be a good idea, but I didn't reserve the weekend, I'll tell you that. But it worked out. She's been done a good job, and it's very good, and I want to appreciate the good times we've had. This is a great weekend for people like us to get out in the country and get away from it all and just relax in the sun and have fun. Who's sitting there? There's a seat here for someone. There's two of them over here, over there. And we got an empty. Well, not for you, miss. Seat over here. Seat. Here, kid, you. Sit right there. Go fast. Here comes a cripple lady. We have heard some very good AA this weekend. We've heard right there. It's all right. I get my room if I usher. We've heard some good AA participation this week. We've heard good meetings. We heard Marie gave an excellent talk last night. We'll hear another good talk tonight, another good talk tomorrow morning, plus the meetings in between. And it just looks as though there's no reason for anybody to ever drink again because we're all feeling good and sober and safe and sane. And yet every year when we gather here, someone who was here last year is drunk and gone. And there are people here this afternoon who will be drunk before we meet again next year. And it seems so unnecessary and so unusual. And I look back at my life and I think, how is it possible that I would slip year after year after year after year? But even that is more explainable than people who've been sober and feeling good and somehow disappear and leave AA without a trace. And I think I'm going to talk a few minutes about that today because I think it's a very common phenomenon. You know, first of all, to come here in the first place, to get sober. I was thinking about this in the old-timers meeting yesterday. There was a number of people got up and said, through the grace of God, I am sober. Now, there are a lot of people, I see them every day, dying on the street, who are not staying sober and who are dying on the street. And that would kind of make one think, maybe the grace of God is a selective thing, that it just happens to some people. I used to think that when I was slipping in and out, when they talked about the grace of God. And I knew that the grace of God were required to stay sober. I never would stay sober because I was too bad to get the grace of God. I was raised in a rather strict religion, and I knew that when I crossed over in my teens, I had become bad, and I didn't want to be bad, but as long as I was bad, I might as well be bad. Because the God in the Norwegian Lutheran Church is not especially receptive to people coming back about the time of their finals and say, oh, I'm sorry now. You know, I'm 70, it's time for me to get back to church. And I lived much of my life with the feeling, I'm sure other people have too, who are raised in a strong church, that you can joke about it and laugh. But I used to laugh and sit in bars and say, you know, someday, you know, if God exists, why doesn't he strike me dead? If God exists, why does Three-Finger Brown, Lepke, Lepgaller, these gangsters live in ease, and a mile away from them in Chicago, bus hits a train hits a busload of nuns and leaves them straying for a mile like a bunch of dead penguins out there. Is that God in action? If God exists, why does he, if God exists, why does Lucky Luciano deported to Italy, live in luxury with women and money and broads. And 20 miles away, the Pope was screaming in agony from cancer. Is that God in action? Is that how he rewards his people? There's no God. I remember reading this treatise, and I've mentioned it a lot of times when I've talked about this German philosopher who pointed out that God is dead. If perhaps he once existed to set the orbs a whirl, but look at about you. He must be dead. There's anarchy except for the natural law that has been set up for eternity. And I like to read those things, but nothing ever helped, because when I got tired and afraid in the middle of the night, I knew I was going to go to hell. And when I'm desperate, I know I'm going to hell. And there's no way out of that. And that makes you very afraid of death, I'll tell you. Very afraid of death. And yet, almost death becomes almost inviting sometimes. At one time, overcome by all my guilts and fears, guilts for many reasons, and absolutely cold sober, I pulled a car into a garage in Texas, and put an exhaust pipe on the hose, and died in desperation. A neighbor saw this and pulled me out of the car and brought me back to life, and they put me in the insane asylum as a schizophrenic with paranoid tendencies. And I was all right. I wanted to be alive again until the guilt. They gave me a lot of shock treatments there, and that helps a lot of guilt, because you don't remember anything you've done ever. Remember, we're going to hip you, boy. And it took me some time to get my memory back from that. In fact, it's a funny thing. I don't remember ever committing suicide, but I know I did. And I've heard about it from my family. I read about it in the paper, old papers. But it's kind of a funny thing. I don't remember that. I don't remember directing an opera at the University of Texas that summer. Don't remember it. I rented the record once and listened to it. And it's just like hearing a band across the lake. You hear strains you recognize, but, you know. I don't remember any of that. But I know it was part of my life because I went through it. I know that I escaped from that hospital. I know they brought me back. I know they kept me there till the next year. And I was supposed to stay there until I got well. Thank God I found a way around that. But all these years I was intermittently going to AA, listening to the same things that I try to teach others today, and wonder why they can't get it. And why would that be? Because of the grace of God. And I could not, if God exists and the grace of God keeps you sober, he's got to be saying, you two can stay sober. You can't. You're bad. You can. You two can't. You can. And I don't think I'd be one of those that's selected. I'm sure some of you have felt that way too. So if God exists and he has grace, why do so many people die drunk? Why do most of the people who come to AA die drunk? Why do most of the people who come to AA not stay here? You know that quotation they use again and again. Well, 50% of the people who come to AA stay sober. I doubt if that ever was valid. It certainly hasn't been valid in the last 50 years. Because it isn't. People come and go. I think what he was saying was that, and I believe what he said, was 50% of the people who come to AA and make an attempt to practice these principles stay sober. They always leave out that little qualifying phrase. Because a lot of people come and go all the time. If, you know, any group that you go to, there's always a bunch of newcomers there. And yet the group stays the same. One or two stay. One or two old guys leave. It's the same thing. We have a very large group in Los Angeles. Some of you know. But the room is full every week. 1,100 or 1,200 people. It's the biggest group in the world. But we never outgrow that room because people come and go, come and go. Every week there's new people. Every week there's old people going. And why would that be if the grace of God is to envelop us, to keep us sober? I think if you're kind of new, you might want to think a little bit about how you stay here. In the first place, you don't have to know about the grace of God. That's the nice thing about it. What you have to understand is that you don't have to want what you have, I suppose is the best way to put it. You know, when I go to work in the morning, I have a little different situation than any of you in this room, I'm sure. I get out of my car, and many times I step over the bodies of men and women dying from alcoholism to get to my office. And at the end of the day, I step over the bodies, sometimes the same, sometimes different men and women, on the sidewalk to get to my car. And when I first went to work there, I used to try to really help these people. I'd work with them and try to help them understand there was a way out of this. And I used to be on that same sidewalk with my teeth kicked out and everything gone. And now I'm doing fine. And I had very little luck, very little success with them. And then I had to stop and remember, if good wishes could help somebody, why did I slip year after year after year after year? Because good men in various cities around the country went to the wall for me, tried to help me, took care of my family, took care of me. And all I ever could, the universal thought in the back of my mind was always the same. I know you mean well, but I'm not an alcoholic. Not like you. I don't know what it is. There's something wrong inside of me. I drink a lot sometimes, but not for the reason you do. You drink because you're a drinker. I drink because I feel too much. And I can't stand the intensity of my emotions. And I had no idea what alcoholism was or what alcohol aspects were for people. And none of us ever do, I guess, by the time we get here for a while, then we find out about it. It's an interesting concept, you know. When this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, was written in 1938, Bill was kind of groping. He was sober 3 years, and he was putting together a book. His number one purpose, of course, was to sell a lot of books so they could start a chain of hospitals to help alcoholics, which, thank God, didn't happen. But he put together this book, and he would read it to other members, and they'd comment on it, and they'd send it out to Akron, and they'd comment on it, and he'd try to adopt what they were thinking about. One of the things that did change, probably for the good, is many of you have read that original version of chapter 5 where it says, you must do this, and this is what you must do, and on your knees you must pray and all. And in Akron they say, that's a little bit too strong. Let's cut that down. Let's make it more voluntary. Here's what we did, not what you must do. But he was writing this book, and a lot of people believe that book is an inspired book. And I believe it is. I didn't used to, but I do now. I come to believe that he did not know enough to write it. Truly, truly, he did not know enough to write it. That book is a miracle. Now, you hear a lot of miracles in AA. People are talking about miracles. You know, a few months ago, I heard a guy say, I got up this morning really early, and I looked in the sky, and the sun came up, and it was a miracle. God had given me another day. Oh, once you get up early tomorrow morning, you'll see another miracle, you dumbbell, you know. Miracles are supposed to be things that are unexplainable. Unexplainable. And that's what this book really is. Because this guy had no background in psychology or abnormal psychology or medicine or anything. He was going on perceived things. Most of the people he looked at were not staying sober. It's a shocking thing when you stop and think. In the first printing of the book, most of the stories in there died drunk. The second printing, most of the stories died drunk. The third printing, most of the stories died drunk. And they were good people. They weren't bad people. But they didn't understand the nature of the illness yet. But he's putting together this book, trying to perceive these things, people coming and going. They were working with people all the time in Akron and in New York. And in 1938, he said, we are a group of over 100 men and women who have stayed sober a year. And he wrote later, that is not exactly true. There were 79 that I knew of, but I thought 100 sounded better. And we all understand that because we're alcoholics the way he is. I mean, you want to round it off a little bit. But he put together this book, and he knew that there was something that he couldn't understand. There seemed to be people that he saw and knew about, and we didn't know about, who seemed to be alcoholics by any definition. And something tremendously strong happens. They have a death in the family. They lose a career. They get a divorce. They get threatened with a divorce. Something significant happens. And they quit. And they quit. And they quit forever. Say, man, no more of that. Then there are also people who to all intents and purposes are alcoholic, who not only are psychologically alcoholic, but physically addicted to alcohol, cannot be taken off. And these people, they are the people for whom treatment centers were originally arranged, could be taken off medically. And as each step of the way, they're taught what they've done with their lives. And look what's happened to you, and look what's happening to your family. Wow, And by the time you get out of there, they quit. Then there are another type of people who have significant things happen to them, terrible things, death in the family perhaps, something terrible loss, and they quit. But sooner or later will always drink again. And these same people can be withdrawn in a treatment center and taught all the nature of their problems and they understand it, and they always drink again. And these are the people Bill Wilson was trying to describe. He said, he didn't know how to describe these others, but he kept saying again and again, alcoholics of our type. Alcoholics of our type are like this. Alcoholics of our type like that. And the big curse of alcoholics of our type is that people have helped us. We learn the nature of our problem. We see what's happening to us. And it becomes such a problem sometimes we have to drink to solve it. Because it's such a remarkable, it's such a strange thing. Alcohol is the best answer I've ever found to internal pain and conflict. And my drinking brings me pain and conflict. So eventually I wind up drinking to forget my drinking. And people laugh and think, but that's exactly what happens. You can wind up drinking to forget your... And people say, why don't you stop? Look what's happened to you. I'll tell you. I had a good case of that this week, and I don't want to make a big deal out of this because we're working on it. But I was called into an adjoining city where the presiding judge of the Superior Court, the top man legally in that part of the state, has been drinking, and he's got a couple DUIs. And so they went to visit him, the law people from the state, and they found him drunk in his chambers. And they took away his judgeship. He was the top judge. Then they took away his judgeship, and they put him in a treatment center over here. And he got out, and he learned the value of his ways, and a month later, he was drunk in another DUI, and they took away his law license. And he kept drinking. His wife and children left him. He went to a treatment center in Arizona, got out, came back, stayed sober for 2 months thinking about this, got drunk and stalked his wife and children and threatened them. Arrested him, put him in jail. Went to another treatment center, because he's a wonderful man, a kindly, good man. He really is. And he got to the treatment center and learned his lesson this time. And 3 months later, they caught him driving drunk and hit and run and crazy and without a license. They tried everything they could to stop the guy. I went to see him in the courthouse of this adjoining city. And this presiding judge, brilliant, outstanding man, in old blue jumper suit, with his hands handcuffed, and said, I don't know what happened. I drank. And I said, I understand that, my friend. And now he has a new problem. He says, but now I'm 60. What's the sense of staying sober? It's all gone anyway. And we all understand that. And he's off. They sent him off to jail for a while. And they've remanded him to my custody in December. Well, it sounds funny. I don't know if I could help him or not, because that last element, the element of surrender, you cannot do that. Everybody's got to do it for themselves somehow. To get that balance, then he has to come and live with the Midnight Mission. And his life depends on it. If he doesn't, he'll go to the state penitentiary. And I hope that's enough to scare him into doing these things. I don't know if it is or not. But it's such a touching thing, and I see it so often. I see things like that's a little dramatic, but everyone's lives are just the same way. I just throw it away and throw it away. And Bill Wilson, writing about this, wrote about people like that, because the people, those first people around Akron and New York were like that. Some of them had really been something, and they were down and out. In fact, that's one of the things that's a little different now, I think, a little different in AA, is because in those days, most of the people that came to AA were people who had grown up, made some sort of a basic adjustment to living, started drinking, then went to hell. But at least they knew what to go back to. And so in our book, he talks about returning to normal living for alcoholics. But since then, AA has changed its flavor a lot. It's full of people who never made a basic adjustment to living. They just got goofy and have been goofy ever since. Yeah. and alcohol started working, saying, return to normal living. What's that? Does that mean just drinking beer? Yeah. The thing about A, most people, we have to teach the basics of living today. We have to teach the basics of how to live in society. We do it over a period of time. And that's, but this capturing the ability to stay sober. The analogy I used to think of it is really correct, I guess, is that a couple of years ago, I took one of my grandsons out in my backyard on a driveway to teach him how to ride a bicycle. And I put him on the bicycle, I showed him what to do, and he fell down. And I put him up again, and he fell down. And two or three of those things, and he was bleeding from the elbow, and his mother came out and raised hell with me. And I had given her life. She took him inside and said he was a poor boy, and I gnashed my teeth. And a week or so later, I snatched him when she wasn't around and tried it again. And down he went. And I really felt bad. I've worked so hard in AA, tried to be something, to make a comeback from nothing, and to find out that after all these years, I have a retarded grandson that can't ride a bicycle. I had such hopes for that kid. I had to release him. Joe, we'll try it some other time, but maybe we can go to the show or something. We can do that. And once I released him and somebody else helped him, he learned to ride the bicycle right away. But I had given him the basics, of course. But learning to ride a bicycle is a strange thing. I love that little boy. I would give my life for that little boy. But I could not give him the ability to ride a bicycle. Everybody's got to learn for themselves to ride a bicycle. Nobody can give it to you. You can give people you love, you can give them your money and love and all sorts of things, but you can't give them the ability to ride a bicycle. Everybody's got their own bicycle, fall down, get up and fall down. Some never do learn, say, don't keep doing it. But most of us who ride a bicycle know that somewhere along the line, one day, out of nowhere, you get a sense of balance. You can't explain it. You can't explain it. You don't know. You can't give it to anybody else. But now you can ride a bicycle for as long as you live. Or you can ride a motorcycle. You can do anything. And you don't know, you can't explain it. And it's almost that way with sobriety, it seems like, sometimes. Some people seem to get sobriety their first trip. And some people go year after year and keep falling off and can't understand why. And that's the puzzlement of this whole disease. When I said this book was a miracle, I'll tell you why it was a miracle. Because a guy who didn't know enough to write it wrote a book that has changed more alcoholic lives in the last 60-odd years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind for alcoholics of our type. There has never been an effective answer to alcoholics of our type. There have been people in churches who swore off in the church and swore off of this reason and that. But alcoholics of our type have never had a chance. And the only one thing wrong, really, is that we deal with the emotions of humans, which we'll never get rid of. And in alcoholics, they seem to be accentuated a little bit, a little more intense. You know, I like the term alcoholic emotions because it makes you kind of a misunderstood, sensitive person. Another word to describe those emotions are immature emotions, childish emotions. If you want to see alcoholic emotions, stop by any schoolyard and watch them play for a while. Mine, not mine. I love you. Hate you. And unfortunately, it's all very cute, except those emotions change my perception of reality. And everybody in this room knows how that goes sometimes. You have made up your mind for this, and tomorrow it looks different. And from hour to hour sometime when you're having a difficult time, and ups and downs and vagaries. And that's why I think so often alcoholism is described by well-meaning people as something like manic depressiveness or schizophrenia, because we go from one to another. The swings are so large, much larger than in most lives. And so they want to ascribe particular emotional illnesses, and that's why it's so common for doctors and to prescribe medications for these illnesses, which dull you down so you don't have those swings. But you don't live in reality completely either. The thing that makes Alcoholics Anonymous so startlingly strange and good is that somehow here, if you can get this balance on this emotional bicycle, there's ways to do things that will enable you to stay sober as long as you live. Not only stay sober, but to feel good most of the time. And that's the best you can do. Because no matter how hard you work the program, you never rise above human being. And human beings have ups and downs. And most of us think, well, I've had a bad day. Maybe I need professional help. You know, they used to come to the Pacific group and tell me that I need professional help. I said, go over there and sit next to him. He's a psychiatrist. Maybe he'll talk to you during the coffee break. You know, but it is. They think AA is all right, but I need more spiritual life. If I could just get back to the church and bury myself in the church, I think that's fine. But I've been flown across the country 3 times to a place in the East where they send alcoholic clergymen from all over the country. And they come in there weeping in frustration because they want sobriety. They can't stay sober. They love God. And they feel they're letting God down. And AAs teach them how to stay sober. And they go back to their parishes, and now they can love God and stay sober. Everybody wants to find some way to do it other than AA. And I found another way, so I'm going now. But once you can stay sober, once you can overcome that hurdle, then you can stay sober. And then comes the second part of the equation. You somehow got to stay sober. There's only two really possibly threatening times in alcoholism. One is before you get sober, and one is afterwards. Now, you would think that going through a lot of pain and agony to get here to stay sober, and now being sober, you would be grateful every day for the rest of your life. No way, Jose. You know, because human beings just take things for granted after a while. That's why I always, you know, I remember, dumb little example, but moving out here in California and lived in Pasadena for a while near the mountains, and my parents came out, my father came out and said, what beautiful mountains. I said, what mountains? I'd seen them every day. I forgot they were there. People who move to the ocean lose the ocean. That's why I wouldn't want to live on the beach, because after a while you lose the ocean. You don't see it anymore. And it's got to be something out of your range of thought. Nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. I wish it were, but human beings, the example I've used so many times, but it's still the best one I know, is when you're a sponsor and you get these calls from newer people, that hideous call that is the worst of all. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. And you hopefully have your aha machine on and put... And they talk for some time, and you go, gee, that's interesting. And you, I know I had another girl 2 weeks ago, but I know this is the one. God, when I looked up and saw her walking out of detox, I just, you know, just makes you wonder if maybe Prozac is not really the answer after all. There's a great new book out, incidentally, called Prozac Flashback or something, written by an outstanding doctor who has done a research on Prozac, and he talks about all the people who have committed suicide on Prozac and other things, and a little bit about what it does to the brain. You might want to read it the next time you're looking for an easier, softer way. But, you know, and you may imply to them, this may not be the final all-time happiness of your life. Oh, I know it is, though. God, we were having lunch today, and we reached for the salt, and our fingers touched, and there was a spark. I could actually see a spark. And you hate to have to tell them the facts of life, so sometimes you don't. It isn't going to stay this way. It isn't going to stay there. No matter how deep your love is, even if the chance in 3 billion that your relationship lasts for any length of time at all, and you finally get married, and you live in a little house 3 years from now, and a little toddler playing in the yard, and there's a white picket fence, and you just know you're the happiest man in the world, and you're going to be sitting at lunch, and you're going to reach for the salt, your fingers are going to touch, and you're going to say, "Give me the goddamn salt." It's just the nature of life. It's just the nature of life. And so it is almost incumbent upon people like me, and I presume like people of our type, to find some way to intermittently induce feelings of gratitude and remembrance why I'm here. So left to my own devices, I will not maintain it. That's one of the great reasons for meetings. That's one of the great reasons for sponsorship. That's one of the great reasons to helping other people. It's not because you want to be intrinsically good, although we'd like to think we're being self-sacrificing. But we are also getting continuing efforts. And this grace of God continues. I had a great deal of difficulty understanding that to get sobriety and to maintain sobriety. Because when you stop and think about it, and I know some new people here, this, what is the grace of God? What is the grace of God? I didn't even want to hear about it. Well, another term for it, you might call it peace of mind. Could call it serenity. Could call it some ability to live in the world without perpetually your mind being on fire. I remember I was sober a little while, and I was avoiding God, and I had to stay away from God because if God existed, I was doomed, and I couldn't bear it. So I was trying to list my sponsor. I had to have a higher power, and I selected my sponsor. And people would laugh at me at the club and say, "There's that guy who thinks his sponsor is God." I never thought he was God. But I thought that he might, I believed in him, I could bear to believe in him. But he, in my efforts to do what he said, once in a while, I got a little bit better, and I got to believe in AA. And when he stopped doing the things that he was teaching me long enough, and got drunk and died, it put an exclamation point on it. People said to me, "You know, you're only 3-4 years sober now, you're not wrapped too tight at best, and now your sponsor's drunk. Is this going to kill you?" And I said, "No, that really proves what he said is true. He said, if you don't do these things, you'll get drunk." And he stopped doing them. He got drunk. That's it. Then I got another sponsor who was the most active person I know. I didn't like him very much because he was a little too smarmy for my taste, but but he was active, and he became my sponsor for many, many years, and he pulled me along. But over a period of that time, in the early years, I became able to identify the grace of God. And the analogy I was able to think of in my first year of sobriety, I guess because I heard a tape of me when I was 14 months over, somebody played it for me, and I believed it then, or at least I was talking about it. And that is this. It's the analogy I was able to think of is this, that either God has grace for everybody, or else he just has grace for some. If he just has grace for some people, I don't want anything to do with that God anyway, to hell with him, because he won't like me. But if he has grace for everybody, or peace of mind, or love, or whatever the hell you call it, if it means everybody, how come some people don't get it? How come I don't get it and other people do? And I finally stumbled onto an analogy that I thought was helpful. It's like in Los Angeles, Channel 4 is up on top of the mountain. And it sends out a picture, clear, perfect picture, to every TV set within range. It doesn't care what kind of a set you got, whether you got a Sony or a Mitsubishi or an old General Electric, what the hell it is. It sends out this clear, perfect picture. And a lot of TVs don't even turn on. They don't work very well. And they got knobs people don't understand, but most people at least fiddle with them and they get some kind of a picture. And I had to think of God's grace going out like that. He loves everybody. He wants everybody to have a clear picture. He wants me and you to have a clear picture, but I'm not getting it. But he's not going to come down and fix my set. He's not a repairman. I think sometimes in the fall, I think about that. I like football a lot. I have two TV sets set up side by side in my den so I can watch. And these same grandkids, and some others that join in, They're getting a little older now, so I'm able to slap them so they stop doing it. But when they were younger and I couldn't really reach for them, when I'd go to the washroom or something, they'd come by and change all the knobs. And I'd come by, there'd be blue pictures and people... I immediately learned over a period of time, I learned what they have. I learned that the vertical hold gets the picture to stop going this way, and the horizontal hold gets them... And the tint gets their skin back from blue to pink and on and on. And there's nothing to it. And I think that's the way my life has been, in a sense. There's a picture coming through of God's grace, and I don't know how to run the knobs. And AA has given me some knobs, and I don't understand how they work. I don't understand how the knobs of my TV work. I know that somewhere then there's some electrons doing something. Boom, boom, boom. But who cares why? I don't care why. And yet, I have the same set of knobs, only my knobs don't say vertical hold. And they don't say horizontal. They don't say tip. They say things like prayer. They say things like meetings. They say things like extending myself to help somebody else when I don't feel like it. And on and on. And I've discovered those knobs, when I do them, bring in a rather clear picture. But unfortunately, my living TV set seems to be on the back of a pickup truck. Every time I get a picture, it goes, oh, shit. You know, just, and somehow or other, I have to maintain the knowledge that if I keep doing these things, I will intermittently get a good picture. If I get tired and blasé and say, enough of that, I'll find a better way, the picture gets bad, and I don't blame me. I blame NBC up on the hill. And so somehow I have to... Since I'm weak, I wish I were intrinsically strong. I'm weak. And I've come to believe almost every human being is sad. Even the strong ones are weak at the right places. But I have to surround myself with people doing the same things. And they will pull me along. And I have to force myself sometimes to remember the intrinsic basic laws that I've learned in my early sobriety. Do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be when you said you would be there. Don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back. Children, waiters and waitresses, employees. On days you know you're having a bad day, and we all have them, watch that damn mouth, because you can cut people to ribbons and not even be aware why they turned on you. And all these things. And nobody ever learns them very well, but you have to remember them. But the gradual result, of course, is that little by little, this picture comes through. There's always, I guess, as human beings, we'll always have a little snow in the picture and we won't do it very well. I think it's kind of sad sometimes because we like to think there are some people who automatically have that picture all the time. And they lead us. Here's what you do and you'll have it all the time. But you won't have it all the time and they don't have it all the time. You know, think about these evangelists who, on television, you find Jesus, you'll be all right. And over here in India, gets nailed with an old hooker on the street, you know. Well, maybe it was all right. I have no way of knowing. Alcoholics Anonymous is made up of people, strange people who have a lot of strengths and a lot of weaknesses. And we have to find a way to cope with those weaknesses so they don't dissipate our strengths. Over a period of time, we somehow have to remember that the actions that we must take to work on those knobs have to continue to be taken. It is so inviting sometimes to say, well, I've done my share. I remember I've seen a couple old-time speakers who said, I don't go out anymore because I've spent my time on the freeway. Let somebody else do it. I don't go to meetings much anymore. I'm all right. And watch them get more and more sour and more introverted. Because the enemy of people like us is time to get inside of ourselves, I think. You know, that's one of the great reasons why psychiatry has never been effective in the treatment of alcoholism. It has never been effective in the treatment of alcoholism, and good psychiatrists know it, and refuse to treat people unless they're in AA sober. because psychiatry is really predicated on getting within, looking within, and seeing what's wrong, and finding a way to change it. And alcoholics don't need any more help to be within. I've been there my whole life. Sure, the earth's on fire, but how do I feel? You know? We have to get out. And that's what the actions of AA are about. Now, this is a great... These weekends like this is a lot of fun, great pit stop. And we hear the great speakers. It's really wonderful. But this is not AA. AA is out there starting Sunday afternoon, where there's not... We're not surrounded by 2,000 people feeling good and laughing and playing in the pool and hearing wonderful speakers. Where you are living in the world full of conflicts, and sometimes people act funny and people act strange and your emotions vary. Of course, if you're new, you remember and understand this. That's why they tell you not to get too hungry, angry, or lonely, or tired. It's not because they're bad things, but they change your perception of reality. Things really look different, if you'll ever notice, at least for me. When I'm hungry, everybody around me gets stupid. There's no reason for that, but they do. For Christ's sake, come on! When you're angry, God sometimes wants you to hurt them for their own good. Step in here, I have a piss elm club I want to show you. Boom, yeah. When you're lonely, you kind of know that they're all somewhere having fun, but they didn't tell you, did they? They don't really like you after all you've done. When you're tired, they attack you sometimes. I get on the Santa Monica Freeway every morning out by the ocean, and sometimes I'm tired. I've made some hideous trip, like going to the ABC Club or some hideous thing. I know that's the way I feel, too. Well, it should be the ABC, because that's Friday night. I'd be sleeping the next morning. But someplace in the middle of the week, and you come back, and you're tired. But I've been sober a long time. I know how to look as though I'm okay. And I get out of my car, and I drive downtown on the Santa Monica Freeway, and I hum. I'm just fatigued, but I hum little songs. But they know. They know. Same old lady up around La Siena says, "There's the boy. See the boy in the gray car? He's exhausted. I'm going to cut that son of a bitch off." And then I have to teach her a lesson. For her own good. Now, what AA has done for me, it has done one thing over the years. It has enabled me to understand I cannot chase people past my exit. If I haven't caught him by 4th Street, it's good flying, Red Baron. We'll meet again. And if you do catch him, you can't do anything, but you can go by him and give him a ray. That makes me feel better. Even that is a few years ago, I was coming off the Santa Monica Freeway to the Harbor Freeway, and some little girl cut me off and almost put me in an overpass. I came that close to dying. And I made an exception in her case. I gave her a little run well into the Pasadena Freeway. And I caught her about, I don't know, Avenue 52 or someplace, and I gave her a quadruple ray. Then I suddenly noticed she's just a little girl, maybe 17, the same age my granddaugher was, my little granddaughter, Katie Doherty. And I thought, what kind of a guy am I? I profess to be an AA member, chasing some little 17-year-old girl who's doing the best she can, and I'm, what's wrong with me? And I was so ashamed, and I smiled. And she went, but that's what you face out there, folks. You got to be careful watching these emotions, because they literally change your perception of reality. And over the years, people have, you know, a lot of people have been able to stay sober, and a lot of people haven't. And it is my belief that we have to be very careful also in AA, because I believe there are people in AA who used to be drinkers, who have stopped drinking, who are alcoholics of one of the other types, because they seem to be able to come here and stay sober and not have to do the things that I have to do. And that's dangerous, because they lead people into thinking they don't have to do them either. And they all get drunk, except Typhoid Mary. You know, remember the story about Typhoid Mary? They found a lot of deaths in Massachusetts on Cape Cod, I think about 1900. And they found several families had typhoid fever. There weren't any cases of typhoid fever anywhere. How could this be? And they had a long investigation. They finally found out they had all had the same Irish cook, Mary Delaney. And they got her, and she was suffering from typhoid fever. But she had no symptoms of it, so she didn't even know it. But everything she touched got typhoid fever. And she was just heartsick when she discovered that she'd killed these people. And she just had to put her in a hospital and finally stay there. But that's where the term Typhoid Mary comes from. Someone who survives but kills others. And that happens in this program. And that's why you cannot trust some false prophet who says, you don't have to do all those things. Maybe he or she doesn't have to do them, but I have to do them. And if you're an alcoholic of our type, you will have to do them too. And there's, you know, it's so easy to get distracted from this. And so what is the thing, you know, up in Mary, up in Toronto, I go up there and speak every year one day, and in January, all the good speakers are speaking in Florida. And but I get down there in July. Remember a woman up there asked me one time, every year you talk about how long you slipped and how now you've been sober forever. What's the difference? What made the difference? And what is the difference? Hard to tell. And I thought about that a lot. And the difference, as far as I can tell, is basically this. Being willing to do things I disagree with. I don't know a single sentence that is doing things I don't want to do that I disagree with. If I would say, what is the difference between me and these men and women dying in front of my eyes on the sidewalk in front of the Midnight Mission today? What is the difference? If I had to put it in one sentence, they refuse to do things they don't agree with. They will not do. And that's all there is to it. They may do it very briefly, but they say no. And here we have to learn a different philosophy, I think, if you're new especially. The philosophy of deferred reward. There's not instant reward like having a drink of whiskey and getting that bang. Here we have to take actions, and you have to depend on. That's why it's so good to have someone ahead of you that you believe in, that you respect. Don't have to like him, but you have to respect him. I know my sponsor, the thing that won my heart, is I heard him talk after he'd been my sponsor a while. First, I was about to leave him again, and I heard him talk about emotions that I thought, my God, I'm the only one who ever had those emotions. And he impressed me with that, and I started to feel he might know some of the things that are inside of me. And I began doing things to please him, not for A, screw A, A doesn't work for people like me, but to win his friendship. And that saved my life. Because the actions don't care why you take them. They seem to work the same, but the point is to overcome that inertia. Oh, it couldn't work anyway. You read those steps, there's no way it could help anybody. But yet you talk to people who've been sober for years, and they say, the only thing that's done is these steps. And the people who stop taking the steps gradually get sour and bitter, and they say, well, AA is no longer enough for me. I have to find other therapies, and they get into some deep problems sometimes. They get into this old child of divorced parent syndrome where you play one therapy against another to find an easier, softer way. Probably the great classic example of that is the man who carried the message to Bill Wilson, Ebby, and he carried the message to Bill Wilson, and he stayed sober, then he got drunk. Then he stayed sober. Then he got drunk. He could not stay sober. They finally sent him down to Texas, down to Dallas. They sent him over to Midland, Texas, and some guys took care of him. And he got away from all of that pressure and of AA International, I guess. And I heard him talk in 1960 at the International Convention, the only talk he ever gave. And Bill Wilson, they said, we see sometimes you hear people say here, well, the book doesn't mention sponsors. Maybe not, but I heard Bill Wilson say, I'd like to introduce my sponsor. which is kind of an important thing. Book doesn't mention meetings either. But he gave a good talk, and he went back to Texas again, and he got brooding. You know what he got brooding about? Because Bill Wilson got more attention than he did. And he said, I brought the message to Bill Wilson, and they just treat him like a god. They treat him like I'm just some stepchild. And he had some other problems with the woman, and he started taking pills and got drunk again, and Bill took him up to a home up in New York State, and they just kept him in a rest home till he died. But now here's the guy he could not take directions from Bill Wilson, because he told Bill Wilson how to get sober. And now Bill Wilson's giving him directions. That's why it's sometimes difficult, not always, but sometimes difficult to have sponsors who have significantly less sobriety than you have. Because when the chunk hits, you think, yes, I'm sure it looks that way at that length of sobriety, but I see it differently. We have to be able to surrender. I think surrender is the number one word here. To surrender to actions that whether or not I agree with them. And that's why it's important to have someone issuing those directions that I believe in and trust. Because if I don't, I don't dare overrule a series of, I mean, I can debate my mind. All of us do that, debate their mind. I don't think that's right. But I heard one of the guys I sponsored once, he said, you know, if God told me to go north and my sponsor told me to go south, I'd go south. Because I might be misunderstanding God. And I've misunderstood God a lot. My early days, I heard his message, but I just missed part of it. I missed the do not part of it. Do not quit your job. Whatever you say, God, I quit. Don't get in a fight in the AA club. Well, get in a fight in the AA club? Okay, Father. No. I have to be very careful because my frame of mind will sometimes interpret God's messages differently on different days. That's why it's so important that I hear the voice of God spoken through someone with a rational mind and who is not involved in my crap. And that's what it all boils down to. It isn't any big, difficult thing. We are here sober. That means the grace of God is working on us. And now it is necessary for me to keep at least tuning that set to a certain degree as long as I live. If I'm uncomfortable, I got to tune it a little more strongly, I guess, to get a better picture. But you and I are never going to become perfect. We're never going to become wonderful. I think one of the greatest things that Bill Wilson ever did, he took that Oxford movement, those four absolutes, and threw them out. Because people like me are absolute people. I want perfection. I'll do it right. Where the hell with it? And in AA, that's not correct. Absolute honesty. Well, I cheated a little bit, so to hell with it. Not going to try that anymore. You know. The great thing at the end of chapter 5 that we read, no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is, we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. And some days we're not as good as others. And some days we're weak and heavy laden. And some days we're strong and powerful, apparently. And some days we feel good, and some days we feel sad, and some days we feel lonely, and some days we feel glad. But it continues, the flow of life continues. When I work with others, that turns a knob in me that makes that picture a lot better. I sometimes don't feel like turning that knob because it's inconvenient. I don't want to do that anymore. I'm tired of listening to people whine. When do I get mine? Never realizing that that's how I get mine. And sitting in those meetings, I can't imagine what it would be like not to have a home group where they expect me every week. And I sit there and, an appearance before God that I'm here in my seat. And I, you know, people say, well, I go to meetings. Where do you go to? Well, I go to meetings when I feel like, you know. It would just seem lost to me. That is not turning any. It's turning a knob very poorly. I think of the knobs are sponsorship. If you can't always sponsor people, there's not always people to sponsor. But you can be helpful to new people. You can be helpful to new people, and you can give them a little of your time, and you can offer a ride home, and you can maybe buy them a meal if some poor bastard isn't eating right, and do little things like that, even though it's inconvenient. And you can pray and ask God for strength to know His will for you and the courage to carry it out. And you can take little efforts. And when you realize that you've been acting like a fool again, you can say, I'm sorry. That's a hard thing to do. When you're new, you hate to do it. When you're old, you hate to do it. But you say it. The steps of AA are not designed to make you wonderful or perfect. They're designed to get this picture a little bit clearer. And it comes and goes. And so I think the greatest thing I got to remember, no matter what happens to me, the path of sobriety continues. The path continues, and I must take the steps necessary to keep me on the path. And hopefully I will feel good. I sometimes think about that, and I think the best psychiatrist I ever knew told me that I would have to take medications for my mental illness as long as I live because of the intensity of my emotions. Successful suicide, slashing my wrist another time, being in locked down in a veterans hospital in a padded cell. I mean, mentally gone. When I'm, that's why I drank, because it eased it off. And now I have no drinking and I can't stand it. And I think about that. What am I doing? One of the great things that happened to me is when I was new, no one would give me any medications on charge accounts. And so I had to find some other way out of the pain, and the pain drove me into taking steps and actions to please that old man that changed my life. And now I haven't had a medication in 42 and a half years. And I haven't had any therapy except Alcoholics Anonymous. And I cringe when I hear people get up and say, well, AA is all right for my drinking, but what about my emotions? That's what it's about. It has nothing to do with your drinking. It has something to do with your ability to perceive life in a positive way. And it is my believing that you do that, you'll stay here. When I was in that Texas nut house at Big Spring, they took me off the electric shock ward because they put an alcoholic ward, and I hustled this guy into thinking I was an alcoholic. And they transferred me to the alcoholic ward. Les Ross ran that ward. And I'd never been to meetings in that area before. And how they started the meeting, it was just hideous, you know. It might be okay for you. You heard a little bit of it yesterday, you know. Most in California, we say, my name is Fred, and I'm an alcoholic. We'll say, hi, Fred. In Central Texas, they say, my name is Fred, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it's not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind-sedating medication since my sobriety day. And for this, I'm truly grateful. Then they all say, ha, Fred. Now, that may be all right for somebody when you're just coming off shock treatment. Just, ah! Now, I thought if I ever got in a position of power where I could stand up and give a talk, I wouldn't give them some song and dance like that. I'd tell them the truth. And I'm going to tell you the truth that I've learned in 42 and a half years. I've learned after I got here that I was an alcoholic. Sometime after I was here, I discovered what alcoholism was. So I could really say, my name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it has not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind-sedating or tranquilizing drugs since October the 31st, 1958. And for this, I am truly grateful. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.